There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
A very, very good afternoon. Welcome along to another edition of The Grill. It's myself, Robbie Greenfield, taking the place of host Tom Urquhart as we talk all things sport between now and 6 o'clock this Saturday afternoon. We're just days away from the start of the ICC Cricket World Cup. It all gets underway Thursday, May the 30th, when hosts England take on South Africa at the Oval. And that begins a festival of cricket featuring one of the most competitive 10-team lineups in the history of the tournament. We'll be hearing from the key protagonists and previewing the action this afternoon from 4 o'clock. We'll also be discussing some of the biggest stories in football from the past week, checking in on qualifying for the Monaco Grand Prix. That gets underway at 5 o'clock local time. Looking ahead to the Roland Garros as the second Grand Slam of the year in tennis prepares to serve up another feast of action at the French Open. And there's some live rugby to stay across as well. There's loads to discuss then between now and six. If you want to join the conversation, then just drop us a message on 4001. You're listening to The Grill live at Barasti.
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, with more sport, the latest headlines, and top debate on Dubai Eye 103.8.
A very, very good afternoon. Yeah, what a beautiful day it is. It's a relatively cool day for this time of the year in the UAE, but we've got a hot lineup of sporting action to discuss between now and 6 o'clock. And to do that, I'm joined by an illustrious team of panellists, probably the best that we could have possibly assembled for this afternoon. Let's start with the man on my left. It is a regular voice on The Grill. It is Carl Van Rosenvelt.
Yeah, very good afternoon, Robbie Greenfield. As you say, a beautiful day, and a beautiful day for sports, especially if you are a rugby supporter. What I can tell you is we'll have the Pro 14 final this evening. Leinster find themselves in another final this week, and the big question is, can they go the full distance? We've got the semi-final in the Gallagher Premiership. Saracens take on the Cherry and Whites. That's Gloucester at 4:30. And of course, the big talk is Danny Cipriani facing Owen Farrell. How will that one go? At 7:30, we've got Exeter Chiefs kicking off against Northampton Saints. And then, as I say, a lot of Super Rugby. Currently, we've got one live game at the moment. It is the Waratahs taking on the Jaguars. Jaguars leading that one 17 points to 10. And earlier this morning, the Crusaders beating the Blues 19 points to 11.
Yeah, got a match between the Stormers and the Highlanders at 5 past 5 getting underway to look forward to as well. Loads of rugby to stay across. CVR is all over that. Let's bring another man into the conversation, making his Grill debut. It is a regular voice on our Monday Night Football show. It is Rob Wadsworth, the director of the Nadalshiba Sports Complex.
Good afternoon, Robbie. How are we doing?
Very good, Rob. There's lots of football to discuss, even though we are in that little, I suppose, watershed between the two main cup competitions in Europe. Of course, the Copa del Rey coming up later, but loads of football nonetheless to discuss. We're looking ahead to the playoff championship decider between Aston Villa and Derby as well. Two old teammates going head-to-head in that one, in John Terry and Frank Lampard. Still lots to be busy about in the world of football.
There is. There's cup finals galore as well. We've got the German Cup final. We've obviously got the Scottish Cup final as well. And then there's the Europa League coming up as well. So, yeah, lots to get our teeth into this afternoon.
We're going to get into that very, very shortly. Let's bring our third and final panellist into the conversation. It is a man who joined us last week. It is a man who knows an awful lot about the likes of cricket and football. It's the one and only Monty.
Good afternoon, Robbie. Good afternoon, everyone. Dubai 103.8.
Great.
A lot to talk about in terms of the warm-up matches that took place even yesterday. Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India's playing today, being one of the favourites. They haven't started so well at the moment in their warm-up game. I can tell you they're struggling, 4 wickets gone. New Zealand are on top. And lots to talk about the transfer market that's been sizzling around ever since the season has closed.
Lots of gossip in that transfer market, Rob, but no action as yet. I guess we won't see any big name transfers until after the Champions League final on June the 2nd.
I thought
June
so.
The 1st.
I think there is obviously some pre-agreements in place already for a few players, I'm sure. And what usually tends to happen is you'll get one big transfer and that'll trigger off the domino effect of other players moving on. So, yeah, we'll wait for the first big one. Expect it to happen after the Champions League, but you do never know.
The big game in football tonight features none other than Lionel Messi. Barcelona taking on Valencia in the Copa del Rey. I know Messi has been speaking at a press conference in the last 24 hours. And interesting to see, guys, that he is still by no means over what happened at Anfield a couple of weeks ago, that 4-0 reversal. The second time in a row that Barcelona have surrendered such an advantage at that stage of the Champions League. And he spoke in somber tones. I mean, Messi, Monty, clearly not over it. And clearly they're still feeling the pain there at the Camp Nou.
Yeah, this is what I would have spoken about today. Is even if Barcelona win the Copa del Rey tonight, it would be their 31st Copa del Rey. But the ghost of Anfield will never die so soon from Barcelona players. Even Gerard Piqué said that was a horrible night for them. And he couldn't express himself as to what exactly happened. And the same thing Messi as well, saying that the Champions League was what he wanted. And the disappointment, I think, would remain with them for a very long time until next season starts, I would believe. Yes.
What's your theory, Rob, as to why Barcelona have not been quite doing it in the Champions League since they won it, of course, in 2015? They beat Juventus 3-1 in that final. And under Valverde, he's drawn a little bit of criticism for the style with which Barcelona, you know, a team that has Messi is always going to be pretty easy on the eye. But the directness of the style of Barcelona, in contrast to some of the teams that perhaps... Well, the obvious one being the team under Pep Guardiola, which played such mesmerising football.
For sure, there's certainly been a style change, absolutely, and that has clearly had an impact on the way team play, clearly, but also probably the confidence in their manager, I'd suggest. I think there's a couple of other factors there as well. You've got players that are starting to come towards the latter end of their career, so they're going to start to think about the transition of those players through. There's certainly some older heads in there that would clearly be able to manage and support the team moving forwards, but I think that's had an impact on the team, and those younger players that are coming into the side maybe haven't quite hit the ground running as they'd hoped and haven't been able to establish themselves in the team as they would have hoped.
Carl van Roosevelt, Lionel Messi is 31 years of age, shows no sign of diminishing in his prowess. He's been sensational once again this season. Do you think he'll lift another Champions League trophy?
Yeah, I personally think he will. But, you know, to add on to Robert's point, I just kind of feel from a Barcelona's perspective that he's kind of their go-to guy. And if he gets it wrong on the night, which he very seldom does, might I add. But I found that night at Anfield, they somehow just seem to time up a bit. There's no other player that kind of takes the lead and kind of kicks on for Barcelona. And I think, as you said, this is a monkey that they've been struggling to get off their back for a long, long time. They lost to teams where they've always been at their advantage. And I kind of think, you know, maybe it could just be a mental thing with them where they kind of got to go sit back, regroup themselves and kind of say, look here, if Messi's under pressure, there's somebody that's got to take the lead. Because in that first game against the Liverpool, he was unbelievable. You know, the Liverpool couldn't contain him. And somehow in the second game, I felt that Liverpool kind of found a way to contain him to a certain extent. But then you have to ask the questions of Coutinho. You need to ask the questions of Suarez. You need to ask the questions of these other players to come to the fore. And I kind of think that they're not taking enough responsibility when Messi is under pressure or maybe not quite showing the form that we know he can.
And I think that's a clear thing as well. You're right, Cal, on the leadership of the team. See, they've lost players like Puyol. They've lost Iniesta. They've lost Xavi, leaders in the team. And they haven't been able to replace them successfully to be able to give them that maturity on the pitch. And that's had a big impact.
Have they lost a sense of team? Because you say there everything revolves around Messi, and I absolutely agree with you. I mean, Suarez is a fantastic goal scorer in his own right. Coutinho has not had the best of seasons for Barcelona. But back in the day, 10 years or so ago, Barcelona was a unit, wasn't it? Which Lionel Messi was an integral cog of that unit. But the fulcrum of Iniesta and Xavi in the midfield meant the ball was circulating all the time, and it didn't always necessarily, not all the play had to go through Messi. Now are they too reliant? Have they become a little bit too reliant on just one player?
I just kind of feel, if you especially watch the Liverpool game, and you made a very good point now, if you look at back in the days when they had Puyol at the back, you know, he reminds me a little bit of John Terry. You know, he was the master, he would shout the orders, the boy would get in line, and you would think after leaking two goals against Liverpool, or even three, you'd close up shop. And I just find that the last goal that Liverpool scored against him, that was just bad communication, defensive errors, not getting the line straight. And I think they missed leaders in the midfield, leaders in defence to add to Rob. And the minute a team kind of gets under their skin, those players, call it too mature, call it not experienced enough, they can't quite take the lead in those positions from a midfield to a defensive perspective. And that's kind of where they get undone.
Yeah, interesting to see whether... Well, Barcelona will be successful. You'd expect them to beat Valencia in the Copa del Rey final, Rob.
I would do, yes. I'd expect them to win. I'd expect them to come back from that Liverpool defeat and come on strong, and I would expect the Barcelona win tonight.
11 p.m, that one gets underway. Monty, it was interesting to see as well,
yep,
on the other Champions League flip side of the coin between Spain and England, that Real Madrid did not take kindly to a couple of quips made by Mauricio Pochettino about practicing at the same training facility that Real Madrid use and actually staying at their club grounds.
Yep.
They've refuted that. He made a quip as well about managing the team one day. All tongue-in-cheek, but Real Madrid didn't see the funny side.
No, they didn't. And with Real Madrid, they've had a disappointing season this year. So right now their focus is on next season. And with Mauricio Pochettino, and even Liverpool for that sake, have gone to Spain for hot weather training, and the players over there are preparing themselves for the big match. Real Madrid, with this is the problem with them. They're a very self-centered football team. So they always think about is themselves and themselves. They don't really accommodate other teams. So they have to change this mentality within the team as well. They have to. There has to be a lot of changes. So it all depends on the top management, the Florentino Perez, how he tries to look at the future of the club. Basically, yeah.
There's a lot of work to be done, more so for Real Madrid than Barcelona. And if we look at the last 10 years of European football, of Champions League football, off the top of my head, I think it's only Chelsea, Bayern Munich and Inter Milan that have won the Champions League, aside from both Barcelona and Real Madrid. Are we potentially coming to an end with four English teams now in the finals of both the Europa League and, of course, the Champions League final? Are we seeing the pendulum swing the other way? Is Spanish dominance, preeminence in Europe starting to wane a little, Rob?
Well, obviously you can see that this season, but I think, as we've discussed a little bit on Monday Night Football, is that football's cyclical. So obviously it's the British team's turn at the moment. They've got to the four finalists in the Champions League and Europa League, and they are having a fantastic season. The money plays a huge part in it. Clearly the finances that the Premier League can develop, and the clubs can invest in the teams and the players, is having a huge impact on it. And the European clubs haven't got that TV money, which is fundamental to what they've been able to achieve. So yes, at the moment, it is clearly a success for the Premier League clubs, but I think, let's remember, it is cyclical. There will be a time when the Spanish teams come back, the German teams come back, and the Italian teams as well.
You mentioned that money, and that money is being dangled in front of both Derby County and Aston Villa, Carl Van Roosevelt. It's worth £170 million to the winner this championship playoff on Monday at Wembley. Frank Lampard, of course, who has just been lauded for the season that he's had, his debut season in management with Derby County. John Terry ably assisting Dean Smith for Aston Villa. You'd expect Villa, having the strongest squad, to go into that match as favourites, but we saw what Derby did against Leeds in the penultimate game. Very capable of springing an upset.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of like your bonus at the end of the year, Robbie Greenfield.
Yeah.
But as you say, what an outstanding job, firstly, Frank Lampard has done with Derby this year. They were so successful in the FA Cup. I've always liked Lampard as a player, as a leader, very, very intelligent guy. Of course, now the rumours all over the media that he could be returning back to Chelsea. In what capacity, we don't know. The owner of Derby said, we definitely want to keep Frank there for next season. And I think, you know, Derby kind of, we kind of wrote them off, and all of a sudden they came back. So I think it's going to be a massive game between the two. Aston Villa definitely go in as the favourites, but I kind of fancy Derby to sneak this one. I just think that Frank has shown, he's beaten a couple of big teams in the FA Cup this year, and he's just kind of shown that he's a very, very smooth operator. So I'm looking very, very forward to it, and I think it will be a fantastic story, especially from a coaching perspective. Because the one thing I do like about Frank Lampard, I think he's gone about the coaching thing the right way. You know, he's gone into the first division, kind of earning his stripes or earning his wings or whatever you want to call it. He hasn't just gone to a big Premier League club, which I kind of find Ole's done it the wrong way around. Yes, he has been with Cardiff, which is a smaller club, but he's kind of thrown himself to the wolves. So I kind of like the momentum that Lampard has built up with himself. I think it's going to be absolutely fantastic, and I kind of fancy him just to sneak it in.
And I think that's great for two managers as well. You've got Dean Smith at Villa, who's done a similar job. And so it's great that we've got two British managers there doing wonderful jobs for those clubs. And the success they've both had has been incredible. And Derby are on a fantastic run at the moment. I think they've only lost one in the last 12. So going into those playoff finals, they're on a fantastic run. So I think they've got a real chance.
And yet the more success these guys have, the better they do, the more likely they are to be poached by a bigger fish. That is just the way of the world when it comes to football. We'll take a short break. We'll continue this. We'll hear from Frank Lampard. In fact, he's been speaking on the eve of this game. He's been trying to distance himself from these very persistent rumours linking him with a sensational return to Stamford Bridge.
Unbelievable goal!
This is The Grill, live from Barasti. Enjoy your weekend with a 99 dirham main and a hot lunch combo.
Yeah, we're building up to some big finals in the world of football, some showpiece events. It'll culminate in Madrid with the Champions League final between two Premier League teams, Liverpool and Tottenham Hotspur. Before that, there's the small matter of the richest game in football. It sees Derby County take on Aston Villa for a place in the Premier League that, to the winner, is worth approximately £170 million. It is quite ridiculous. Let's hear now from Frank Lampard. He's been desperately trying to get away from the stories in the press that are circulating, linking him with the pressure that's on Maurizio Sarri with the Chelsea job. A lot of people expect Frank Lampard to be offered that job, and he's been discussing it in his press conference.
I said it, I don't know how many months ago, a few months ago,
And firstly, I think I find it quite difficult because they've got a game coming up. More importantly for me, we've got a game coming up before that. And also they have a manager in Sarri who's, you know, trying to get them to win that final. So it's been a bit of an obvious link all season. If I say it's maybe because of where we're at in the final and we're being talked about and we've had a good year and then I get linked because of my 13 years at the club, I understand the link. But in terms of how I'm seeing it, I've got no... I don't want to think about it. I don't want to talk about it. I want to talk about Monday. I want to work with the team. I want to get this over the line for us. And we've got a really difficult game. So, yeah, it is what it is, to be fair. That's absolutely my standpoint on it. And my focus is on us on Monday.
I totally understand that. I can understand that from a Chelsea point of view and a Derby point of view. This is not good timing for either of them. But you can understand it from the Chelsea fans' point of view and the Derby fans' point of view that it's a concern in the background or an excitement in the background, depending on your perspective.
Yeah, well, I'll tell straight away that to the Derby fans that my focus all year has been how well I can do in this job, because this club gave me an opportunity and I want to finish that this season as well as I can. So that's why my focus is so much on this game, and I'm thankful for that opportunity. I've got 2 years left of my contract here and I see no further than Monday. Now, I'll sit down with Mel after the game, which was planned before all this talk anyway, to see... firstly, what the result was on Monday, because that's going to be defining how we chat, and to see where the club goes forward. And as simple as that.
Could you ever say no, though, if Chelsea offered you the job?
I'm not going to answer that question, because it's a headline. And, you know, as I say, when I started out in management, people go, oh, you know, your dream must be to be Chelsea manager. It's an easy link. My dream was to do as well as I can day in, day out to try and be successful. I can't call that one. Those things happen or they don't or whatever. My focus is completely on the here and now.
Very sensible stuff there from Frank Lampard, and he's dealt with those inquiries pretty well. He refuses to engage because he knows that if he engages, that will proliferate with lots of sensationalist headlines, Rob. But is the Chelsea job a little bit soon for a guy like Frank Lampard, who's what, if I'm correct in thinking, he may have only just turned 40. He's around 39, 40 years of age. He's a very young manager. A Chelsea job, as we've seen historically, is not something that lasts very long, and it's fraught with pressure. It's a very difficult job, which a lot of experienced managers like Maurizio Sarri have struggled with. If you're Frank Lampard, do you have to say yes to that?
I think you possibly do, because I think it's for one of those jobs for Frank that it may not happen again, because we know the football works. So it's likely the Chelsea job will come up again. But where he is in his position with Derby, he's obviously done a fantastic job. He's in the interview, he acknowledges that there would be an interest in him from Chelsea, and he acknowledges why, which is great that he has done that. But he's clearly very ambitious. He's clearly very respectful within it all. I think there's a couple of factors there why he should go and take it, really. I think, firstly, you look at the success that other younger managers have had across Europe. You look at Zidane, who's gone in. You look at, obviously, Guardiola, who've younger managers taken into their clubs, who've known the club. They understand the DNA of a club, and they've been able to take them forwards. And I think that Lampard seems to be the type of character who would embrace that, and he would really, really thrive within that pressure of Chelsea, because it's a club that he knows so well. And I think the other factor with it is what's going to happen with Derby. Now, if Derby do get promoted on Monday, that's obviously, if they had a fantastic season, that would be amazing. If they don't get promoted, there are some question marks about how sustainable that financial model they've got at Derby is over the coming season. They've clearly spent quite a bit of money there. There's some interesting developments there. If they don't get promoted, and what the effect that will have on the club. So will that mean Frank might move on anyway?
Who needs this game, this victory more, Villa or Derby?
I think because of the size of the club and the stature of it, possibly Villa. I think Villa do need to get back in the Premier League. They've stabilised. They had some real financial issues following the last playoff final. They lost, obviously, against Fulham last year in the final. That led them to nearly going into administration, I believe, and they had to get rescued. So I think, they've put themselves on the limit in terms of the English Football League and their financial requirements and rules. So they're very much on the limit. And if they don't go up, they've got some challenges as well, I believe.
But if you're a Chelsea supporter, or you Chelsea, or you're Roman Abramovich, why do you want to replace Maurizio Sarri? I mean, he's got experience. He's done his job this year. To me, there's such a differentiation between the third place team and City and Liverpool that I don't care who you are. It's going to be very, very difficult to make that up. He's guaranteed you Champions League football. I reckon he's got a very, very good chance of bringing Europa League. You say he's bringing a trophy to the club. Why do you possibly want to get rid of him?
But there's clearly a disengagement there, I think, isn't there? There's a disengagement between his style of football, the way he plays. There's no connection there with the fans. I don't think the players or the fans really trust him. I don't think there's been some odd decisions he's made during the season. And I just don't think that he's really got that support from the club in hierarchy. And I think that's what puts him in a tricky position in terms of his future at the club.
I think that the fiasco with Kepa in the League Cup final was maybe more of a nail in his coffin than the 6-0 loss to Manchester City.
Kepa did pay him back, though.
Yeah, he did. He very much did, but... You know, you can't have a player refusing to be substituted. It's an absolute flagrant, rebuke for the manager's authority. And, of course, he came out and apologised and said it was all just one big misunderstanding. But it underlined the perception that Maurizio Sarri does not have authority at that club.
I completely agree. And I think that is hard at Chelsea as well with the hierarchical structure they've got at Chelsea. The managers do find it difficult because they... very rarely have an input on signings. I don't think so. I think a number of the signings that they made recently were in place before Sarri joined. So he's using players that he's put input upon him. And so he is in a difficult position, and I therefore feel that he might be coming towards the end of his tenure anyway, because he just doesn't have the respect, he doesn't have the connection with the fans, and the club don't seem to trust him.
Would bringing in a manager like Frank Lampard not be flying in the face of everything Chelsea have done under Roman Abramovich? They've always gone for the fancy European continental style manager. You know, that's been their modus operandum since they brought in Jose Mourinho. They then replaced him. Andres Villas-Boas came in. They had a spell with Philippe Scolari. Carlo Ancelotti, Mr. AC Milan, came in. You know, they've never gone homegrown. They've never looked for British managers under Roman Abramovich. So to do that with Frank Lampard, that would indicate a massive change of direction in the philosophy of the club.
It would do, and that is you're absolutely right about the philosophy of the club. Like United, I suppose, and like other clubs we see in the Premier League, they need to have their philosophy right, they need to have their structure in place, and then build the club to be able to deliver that philosophy. Maybe this is the opportunity for Chelsea. They've got two potential managers coming through now who understand the club, have got the DNA of the club in Frank Lampard and John Terry, who's doing a great job as assistant manager at Villa, who could potentially become managers in the future. So why not look at bringing them in, developing them, and giving them time and the opportunity.
Let's quickly hear from Dean Smith, the Aston Villa manager, not letting this small matter of the £170 million get in the way of a football match.
What we've got probably that can help us is for the last 15, 16 games, we've been playing must-win games. And each game we've taken in isolation, and we've been on an unbelievable run. And, you know, these players can take every credit for the run they've been on. You know, proud history of Aston Villa, and they're the first players to ever have won 10 games on the bounce in any football at this football club. So they're always going to be history makers. They've got that on the side already. They're full of form. They've just played West Bromwich Albion, who finished above us, dominated both games, and I thought the right team went through.
Dean, the estimates are that this game on its own is worth £170 million. Can you not think about that?
Yeah.
Can you try and treat it just as another game?
I can. Very easily.
Honestly?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I can't control the £170 million. That's just the prize of it, or the price of it. All I can control is trying to get the players on the pitch to perform at the highest level they can. You know, and I have to take that in isolation. Yes, after the game, then, you know, one way or another, you're the Championship team or you're a Premier League team. And that's when you have to deal with that.
Is that the most painful defeat in football, Rob? Losing in the playoff final?
It must be. It must be. It's such a long season in the Championship. It's such a hard season. There's some huge clubs in there. And it must be so painful to be so close to the Premier League. You know, you call it the Holy Grail. You call it the Promised Land. There's so much adulation to get there. To lose that playoff final, you must be gutted. And I think even more so because of the impact if you don't go up, because of what could happen to your club. You look at something like, you know, clubs fall through the leagues now. You look at what's happened to Sunderland.
Yeah.
You know, the impact of not going up is almost, could be as catastrophic as the impact of actually getting promoted.
Fascinating to see. It is a Monday kickoff. It actually gets underway. We start the build-up at around about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The kickoff, though, is 6 p.m. on Monday. Aston Villa taking on Derby County at Wembley Stadium. It should be an enthralling game of football. Another big game I want to look ahead to very briefly. the Europa League final. Monty, I'll bring you into the conversation here because Arsenal have had a bit of a blow with Henrik Mkhitaryan and the location of this Europa League final in Azerbaijan's Baku. A country that has thrown an awful lot of money into sport in the last couple of years. We've seen that with the Formula One going to Baku as well. But for Mkhitaryan to be banned from playing in Baku in an international final of that calibre raises an awful lot of eyebrows.
The thing is, the Baku FA and UEFA had cleared the road for Mkhitaryan to play. I think it's his decision at the end and his family's decision to say that don't go because of the political tensions between the two countries, Armenia and Azerbaijan. But it's a shame because it's almost like a once in a lifetime opportunity for players to play in a big final, and it's a shame that Henrik Mkhitaryan has to miss out, because I don't think that anything related to political affairs should come in the way of sport. I think it's bad for the sport, bad for the spectators, bad for the supporters of Arsenal that they don't see one of their star players playing in a final of a big European night.
Yeah. So then I think there's some huge questions to be asked of UEFA here. I mean, they've picked a flagship final for their competition. Yeah, I know it's probably a bit behind the Champions League, but they've picked it in a place where a player can't go and play because they haven't got diplomatic ties, and they've picked it in a location which is just so hard to get to. Yeah. And it's just made it astonishingly difficult for the fans, for the players and the clubs. I know we have to be careful here that we don't take in some Western European arrogance that says the final should always be in Wembley or Italy, but I think UEFA's got some serious questions to ask itself about how it selects these finals and makes sure that A, players can play, B, that fans can get there safely and in an organised way.
Yeah, former manager of Arsenal, Arsene Wenger, was astonished that Mkhitaryan won't be able to play in the Europa League final. Monty, from what you've been saying, there was some conversations that took place that suggested that he might be able to play, but that he's decided against doing so. Given the cloud hanging over the whole situation is very unfortunate. But do you think, Carl, that UEFA should have not chosen a situation, a venue like that, or is that something that's a completely unforeseen circumstance based on the team that qualified for the final?
No, and as Rob says, we've got to be very careful what we say, because there might be some sensitive listeners out there that think we're very Western European supportive, if you want to put it as such. I'm not. I just think the whole thing has been a shambles, to be perfectly honest. You're releasing only 6,000 tickets to Chelsea supporters, only 6,000 tickets to Arsenal supporters, and I think the stadium hosts 60-something thousand people.
Yeah, apparently the UEFA came out and said that's based upon the capacity of the international airport at Baku, which can only hold 15,000 Trenton Transit.
So to me, this is a problem already, because us as supporters and fans of clubs, obviously finals is where we want to be in, you want to go out and support your team. So to me, already that's an issue. Secondly, that you have to let politics get in the way of sports, something that we've been trying to avoid for so many years. And to Rob's point, I just think UEFA should take a serious look at themselves and go, look here, if there was any doubt that a player from whatever teams on the Europa League could not play in the country, I don't think the country's suitable for it then.
And with Mkhitaryan himself, he has twice not gone and played in Azerbaijan recently. When he was at Dortmund, he didn't play. When they played, they had a Europa League tie in Azerbaijan. And then recently this year, Arsenal played against a team from Azerbaijan in the earlier rounds, and he didn't travel. So it's not as if it wasn't known. It's been known all along that they've got a player there who's potentially going to get to the final, won't be able to play. I mean, just going back to a little bit support what Carl says, it's very noble that UEFA choose to select locations for finals around Europe, and I think that's absolutely right and correct. But I go back to my point, it needs to be accessible, it needs to be suitable locations.
But it's the motivation for selecting it that needs to be correct, right? And not driven by the financial imperatives that we suspect and that we know often make these decisions, or they often dictate the way these decisions go. But that will take place on Wednesday, that Europa League final, the Champions League final, which we'll build up to a little bit later on, will take place, of course, the following weekend. Next weekend, we'll see Liverpool take on Tottenham in Madrid. Cannot wait for that one. We're going to talk a change tack a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit of Formula One, building up to the qualifying for the showpiece Formula One Grand Prix of the season. It is down in Monaco, of course. Lewis Hamilton, fastest in Thursday practice. We'll talk a little bit of tennis as well. Keep it locked right here on Dubai 103.8.
Oh, it's a fabulous! fabulous goal.
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, with more sport, the latest headlines, and top debate on Dubai Eye 103.8.
It'll be a strange atmosphere at this weekend's Monaco Grand Prix. That's because this week has marked the passing of a legend of the world of Formula One, Niki Lauda, a three-time Formula One world champion. He passed away on Monday evening at the age of 70, following ill health for quite some time and kidney failure. And the world has been paying tribute to Niki Lauda, a man that could have, perhaps should have, died in that ridiculous car crash in 1976 at the Nürburgring. In fact, he was read his last rites during that particular accident, but made his recovery and actually returned to racing about 60 days later. Quite extraordinary, the journey and the life of Niki Lauda. We're going to hear Toto Wolff, the Mercedes head honcho, pay tribute to him. We're going to hear the thoughts of some of the drivers, Lewis Hamilton, who looked up to Niki Lauda, who was very much a protege of Niki Lauda's, almost too emotional to pass his views. But we're going to hear the views of Sebastian Vettel, of Valtteri Bottas, of Daniel Ricciardo, of Max Verstappen as well. I can tell you, in third practice, the final practice qualifier session, have you got your eyes on that car, Van Rosenveld? Leclerc fastest.
Absolutely, but what I can tell you is just some hot news out of Monaco now is that Sebastian Vettel has smashed into the wall at turn one. Sante Duvete, excuse my French there. So it's a lot of questions around, can they get that Ferrari ready for the qualifying session? But as you said, Charles Leclerc, the native, the man that grew up in Monaco, he knows those streets like the back of his hand. He was leading in P3, followed by Valtteri Bottas, Lewis Hamilton in a third position in the Mercedes, and then, of course, Max Verstappen and Gasly in the Red Bulls 4 and 5.
Yeah, Antonio Giovinazzi of the Alfa Romeo managing to nab sixth spot, and Sebastian Vettel all the way down in 14th following that early departure from this practice session. It's been a horrible season for mainly Sebastian Vettel, but also an overview, it's been difficult for Ferrari because, of course, Charles Leclerc, I believe it was Bahrain, he should have won that Grand Prix and suffered a bizarre malfunction towards the end of the race, which ultimately led to him not winning the race that he should have won as a maiden win.
Fully agree, and I think it's quite an interesting season so far, especially for Ferrari. And the reason why I'm saying this is, are we going to get a scenario where we had with Max Verstappen and Daniel Ricciardo, where Vettel is definitely coming as the number one driver. We know Leclerc, a lot of talent, racing for Alfa Romeo last year. But he seems to kind of showing a lot more potential. And will we see maybe halfway through the season that he kind of becomes the number one driver? And I think if Leclerc can win in Monaco come Sunday, it's going to be very, very interesting to see Ferrari's team tactics going through the rest of the season. The big thing is, as we know in Monaco, those streets are so tight. A lot of race drivers have compared it to racing your bicycle around your living room. And if Leclerc can get pole position, the Ferrari can go the distance, I think it might be a fantastic victory for him there. And then it will be very interesting to see what tactics Ferrari do follow for the rest of the season.
Qualifying gets underway 5 p.m. local time. We will definitely be having an eye on that in the final hour of this show. But I want to hear some of these tributes from the drivers to the great Niki Lauda. We had Daniel Ricciardo, we had Max Verstappen, Valtteri Bottas and Sebastian Vettel all share their thoughts ahead of this Monaco Grand Prix on their experiences and what Lauda meant for the sport.
I mean, for me personally, it was more what I shared with him, you know, the few moments I did have a conversation with him and cross paths. You know, he spent a bit of time in Red Bull. I think he liked our breakfasts more than Mercedes, so he was in there quite a bit. And yeah, naturally we would, you know, talk. And well, I just honestly, it was kind, you know, the words he had for me, whether it was advice or a bit of a witty comment or something, I don't know, it was always ended with a smile or a pat on the back.
My first memories are of course of him being a two-time world champion and being a legend in the sport, and outside of that he was always a great person. He had a lot of humor as well, and just, yeah, a great guy, and very passionate about the sport still even after his career. So yeah, it's a big loss to have won, but of course the biggest loss is of course going out to his family, and of course the thoughts are with him.
For sure, he was always there to support after a good result of the race. But the main thing was, if there was difficult times or difficult race or disappointments, he was there to speak and to support, to motivate. Because, you know, as a racer, he's been in one of the worst situations in racing history. that's affected his career and his life, and he managed to bounce back from those difficult moments. So he knows exactly how a driver's mind works, and it's been a massive motivation for the whole team.
Having had the opportunity to know him, to talk to him, to ask him all sorts of things, how the cars were, how the time was with Ferrari, how was Enzo Ferrari, all these things, obviously, he knows extremely well, and was shocked, I think, as everybody, to hear at the beginning of the week the sad news. So I think it's a big loss for Formula One, for Formula One community, for the sport. It's an icon that we lost, and will be impossible to replace.
He competed, did Niki Lauda, in a total of 171 Formula One races. He won 25 of them, 54 podium finishes. And as we mentioned earlier, that 1976 crash at the Nürburgring in the German Grand Prix, he suffered severe burns and inhaled toxic fumes. There was a lot of talk, in fact, when Tiger Woods made his great comeback at the Masters a couple of months ago, about comebacks in sport. And I think they all pale in comparison to this one. Because 40 days after that, I got it wrong, I said 60 a couple of minutes ago, it was actually 40 days after he was read his last rites in the car. He had third-degree burns. He was absolutely in a horrendous condition, Carvan Rosenvelt. And he was back racing. The courage to actually get back in a Formula One car after something like that has happened to you, but also to overcome the physical trauma and actually get back to competing at the highest level is quite remarkable.
And if memory serves me correct, he came back in Monza. He ended fourth in that race. And I think, you know, we all watched the movie Rush. I think that's where a lot of us got to know about Niki Lauda, the personality that he was. And I think, you know, when he finished that race, the inside of his helmet was full of blood because still of the scars and the burns and so forth that he had. And I think, you know, it just showed what a true competitor he was, because his whole family was very against him going into Formula One. And of course, you know, he then eventually bought a seat into a Formula One team and then really showed, you know, what a great driver he was. And I think that accident kind of showed exactly what Niki Lauda was about: his persistency, his strive for perfection. And you know, we all watch that movie in Russia. We see, we eventually in Japan, where it's pouring down with rain, we eventually says, okay, it's too risky now, I'm not going to do this. And they say that's kind of where his life eventually panned out, especially as a race car driver, where it was too risky, he wouldn't get in the car. But I think if you look at all the tributes coming in for Niki Lauda, and I didn't know him personally, unfortunately, if there's one thing that we do pick up, is what a great support he was, how he was an example for young drivers to look up to. And I think one of the biggest examples of that was he was the major instrument in getting Lewis Hamilton from McLaren to Mercedes-Benz. And we know what a fantastic that relationship was. And Lewis Hamilton has now gone on to win 5 world championships.
I think the other key thing we pick up from the tributes is that he clearly transcends sport. You know, the tributes have come from across the sporting world into what he achieved, what his legacy was, and as you say, the support he had for young drivers. So he's clearly a phenomenal individual and transcended sport.
Also, about Niki Lauda was he gave up the sport once he won the second world championship in 1977, and then he came back and he won the third world championship. So that's inspiration also, because normally it's not that easy to get back into the sport that you left, you know. Like, for example, we see 7-time world champion Michael Schumacher. When he left the sport and he joined Mercedes, he struggled to cope with the sport. But Niki Lauda came back and won his third world championship. And in those days, winning 3 world championships is like, you know, a 5-star performance. Yes.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt. I think only 5 men are above him in that pecking order in the all-time winning ranks of Formula One world championships. Interesting to get the views of Toto Wolff as well, because he was talking about Niki Lauda's opinionated responses to some of the things, some of the goings on in the world of Formula One. And in that respect, he was very much the last of his era.
Very difficult. Very difficult for the team, for all of us. And very, most important, very difficult as a friend. It is one thing that the world and the Formula One community has lost the biggest icon, but it is a totally different and much more difficult situation to have lost a friend. I feel that we have lost what was the heart and soul of Formula One. Niki Lauda could say everything he wanted. sometimes it gave Bradley and the communications team's gray hair. But Nicky's comment would be, who cares? And in a world today where everything is so slipstreamed and corporate, everybody thinks twice what he says because things can be spun around, headlines can be created. It was so refreshing and important for Formula One to have somebody that just didn't care. And I think that's missing.
It's interesting that observation came from Toto Wolff, because I can't think of anything more corporate and slipstream in sport than Mercedes and Toto Wolff, in all honesty. But it is it's a little bit poignant, because he very much was of a different breed of individual, someone who shot from the hip, said what he felt, said what was on his mind. And the racing itself, Carl, the fact that Formula One was a very different beast back then. It was the onus on the drivers. There was a lot less role played by machines and a lot more played by human beings. And it was much more, how can I put this? It was much more confrontational in its very nature. And it was, as we saw in that film Rush, it was a totally different era that they were living in.
Absolutely. And I think, if you look at the history of Formula One, Niki Lauda helped build it. Obviously it was the brainchild of Bernie Eccleston, and Bernie's one of these guys that he doesn't really care what he says or who he offends. They kind of shoot from the hip. And I think Niki Lauda, the James Hunt, those guys were all part of what they like to call the F1 show nowadays. And I think he was instrumental in building up Formula One. And he's also been through the years. He's watched the transition. He's watched how it's changed. It's become a lot more commercial sport than what it was back in those days. It was a bit like a group of guys on a weekend getting their cars out and going for racing against each other. And I think that kind of he changed the sport, really contributed to it. And I think that kind of is how he formed his personality. And I think with that direct approach of his, yes, he's Austrian, very direct type of person, a lot of people got respect from around the world.
What has been the driving factor, Rob, in changing the way that sports people, in your opinion, behave in the public sphere? Is it money? Is it the fact that all there's so much more money in sport now that there's a greater imperative on keeping squeaky clean? Is it social media? Is it a combination of all these factors?
I think it's those two factors significantly, finances and social media. You look at some of the challenges that these athletes face through social media, sometimes just through discretions that are, you describe as normal, but are typically blown out of all proportion. And the scrutiny that they're under to be squeaky clean, to be successful, I suppose, but also to live their lives as expected by us as consumers and as by supporters, is just a huge pressure for them. So I think those are the two factors. Financially, I always think it's really difficult for the athletes, and the ones that I'm sure we've all come across. These athletes, yes, they are well paid, and they do obviously a fantastic job in what they do. None of us would turn down that money. None of us sat here would turn down, if we were offered whatever it is to go and drive a car or kick a football or swing a golf club, we wouldn't turn it down. So it's not their fault. No. They are given this money to do this job, and for some of them it is a job, but it's not their fault. But they're in a privileged position. A lot of them recognise that. They're in a position where they are role models, and again, a lot of them recognise that. But there is a lot of pressure on how they behave.
We crave personalities, don't we, in this modern world of sport, where a lot of it seems to be devoid of personalities. And then someone like a Nick Kyrgios comes along, and he's unquestionably a pretty blunt personality and has done a lot of questionable things, but he cops an awful lot of criticism.
But I've had this chat with you before. Do you blame these sporting people? I'd be exactly the same. And I think you've just touched on it. With social media now, you have to appeal to a worldwide audience, people that have got different beliefs, different cultures, different upbringings, whatever the case might be. Where back in the days, if you were a race driver, you would actually only appeal to the racing community, because the only way I could find out about you is I could read the Sunday newspaper that gets dropped, and I physically have to go to the races. Now I can be anywhere in the world, I can follow social media, and all of a sudden I start forming my opinion. And now if I'm a sponsor or a brand that wants to be associated with you, you need to start appealing to all different type of people. And what's the best way of not getting into trouble, Robbie Greenfield? You should know it. Keep quiet.
Yeah, I don't really have much. But I think the other, unfortunately, a good track record of doing that, Carl.
There's also stories out there. Well, it's actually happening. Is that you have footballers now, young players coming through, who are being fined for social media comments. Right, yes, incorrect ones, but social media comments that happened 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, before they were even famous. Mm. So yeah, it's no wonder it's sanitised. No wonder.
Roy Keane last week, he was so frustrated with Manchester United's performances over the last few weeks. He came out and said that Jesse Lingard gets $120,000 a week to be an Instagrammer. And he just sums it off because that is, you know, sporting personalities these days, if you are good at something, they love to go on social media. And some of them who are not even successful are doing a lot of things on social media apart from the sport that they need to focus on. So there should be somebody there coaching them, telling what's important for them. You're a sportsman. Your first job should be to focus on sports and then on social media. If you're successful, go up there, express yourself. But there are so many who are not so successful at the moment. But then they just go up on social media and it's become part of life for them, basically. Yeah.
The temptation with all sport is to get very misty-eyed about yesteryear, bygone eras. And you can do that very easily in Formula One. Look back at the likes of Ayrton Senna, James Hunt, of course. Of course, Niki Lauda, a classic example of drivers that were very different. They were different types of personality. But you look at the drivers now and it's very sort of monochrome, isn't it? It's all quite vanilla. Even Lewis Hamilton, who is a quirky individual, doesn't tend to say too much that's not in keeping with the status quo.
They become money-making machines, and I think at the end of the day, you know, they've got to stay in line, because to Rob's point earlier, you've got so much to lose when you step out of line. It could be sponsors, it could be a potential drive, it could be brands, it could be so many things that you're saying goodbye to. I mean, you mentioned Nick Kyrgios. Would John McEnroe appeal in today's era with his behaviour? He'd must probably be banned from every single tournament.
Do you think? I think he'd still be a big star.
I don't believe he would.
Can you imagine John McEnroe's
social media? Would he hate Hawkeye? He would hate Hawkeye.
He would.
There would be no chalk blowing out of the stadium.
But imagine his Twitter feed.
Exactly my point. But what I'm saying is, I don't believe that today's society, with everything that goes on around the world, would stand for his behaviour of swearing, abusing umpires, basically giving his opinion on every single society and every single person. I don't believe it would stand today.
And yet we look back and it was almost quite charming, wasn't it?
We loved it, didn't quaint. We? We absolutely loved it.
There you have it. I don't think the umpires at the time loved their altercations with John McEnroe, but we will look forward to what should be an absorbing fortnight at Roland Garros in the French Open. In fact, let's talk a little French Open tennis in the next couple of minutes. Cricket is going to take centre stage after 4 o'clock, so if you like your cricket, do hang around for that. We're going to be hearing an awful lot from lots of the main protagonists. We're going to be previewing some of the lesser known teams in the Cricket World Cup as well. Rumour has it that Mark Archer is even going to interrupt whatever he's doing on this Saturday afternoon to pop by and give his thoughts on the ICC Cricket World Cup. But in the world of tennis, Carl van Roosevelt, I know where you're going to stand on this one. You'll be pleased to see Roger Federer back at Roland Garros.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll walk away with these, what's a 21st Grand Slam. Yeah, no, very good to see him back. But I kind of think that what Roger's not telling us is, I think he's on his swan song. I just kind of get that impression from him. I think he's going to make his final appearance, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if it isn't announces his retirement at the end of the year. I didn't expect big things from him in Roland Garros, and I was kind of surprised by this decision, and that's why I do think it's his swan song, because to me, if there's one tournament that he could still potentially win, I still favour him at Wimbledon. And if you look at his age, his recovery time and things, it makes sense for him not to play in the French Open, get on the grass court, start practicing, you know, kind of getting into the swing of things for Wimbledon. So I was actually very surprised to see him make
the decision.
You really
think this is his final year?
I've just got a funny feeling it is. I kind of think a couple of the losses he's had this year, yes, he did well in Miami, and then he just seems to have, I'm not saying gone off the boil, but I just, if you look at his body language, if I hear his interviews, I kind of think it might be a swan song. I hope I'm wrong, but I just get that impression.
Do you think, is Tokyo 2020 an option for him? Is that something that he would be wanting to achieve?
Surely,
another Olympic
yes,
medal?
That
you not
is.
Think?
Surely.
You could have a point, and I think, yes, it might be in his calendar, but I kind of think he might be saying goodbye to the Grand Slams. I just got that feeling. As I said, I hope I'm wrong, but I just kind of, and to me, the reason why I'm saying that is, why has he decided to play in the French Open when the past 3 years he hasn't played in the French Open? He's always felt that Wimbledon is the one that he can still win.
Thank God that he's world number three. Well, let's not forget, he's still world number three. But you're right. I mean, it does seem like going back to Roland Garros, having not played there since 2015, there might be a motivation. You could certainly... Detective Van Rosenvelt over there has put two and two together, come up with 17.
Because... you know, I'm not so good at the numbers. Because to me, that, in all honesty, as much as I love the guy and the listeners out there do know I'm really his biggest fan, I don't believe he will win Roland Garros. He needs so much to go his way. I think he needs Nadal, he needs Novak Djokovic, he really needs Thiem. He needs the whole of the top 10 to kind of something happen to them for him to actually stand a chance. Yeah. And that's nothing taken away from him. But I, as I said, I don't believe it's a tournament that he himself would fancy himself in.
Fair enough. And Serena Williams, it's got to be said on the other side, chances really running out for her to win a Grand Slam, to tie Margaret Court's record of 24.
Yeah, I still think that, you know, I see she's practicing with Jeannie Beauchart, your good friend, old Robbie Greenfield, this week, and they're out in France training. And I just, if I look at Serena at the moment and I look at the motion she's going through, she always kind of gives me the impression, and once again, I might be totally wrong, that she's kind of got something on her mind. I don't know, she just doesn't seem to have that killer instinct like she used to have. Yes, a lot has happened in her career, but I also think, you know, that we mustn't take anything away from these younger players that are opposing her now. You know, there's a lot of good women tennis players. You know, everybody's trying to throw her off a mantle, and I still believe she's got it in her. I still believe she can break Margaret Court's record. The timing needs to be right. I don't believe it will be at Roland Garros. I kind of fancy at the US Open. Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you, Monty. I think the US Open is a place where she's very at home. She's very comfortable on the hard courts. That's where she practices a lot, and then obviously she's got the home crowd advantage. So if she has to do it, I fancy she'll do it at the US Open this year.
Rafa Nadal is going for his 12th French Open title. I mean, that is just absurd. That is one of the great records in all of sport. Novak Djokovic going for his own absurd record, to for the second time in his career to hold all four Grand Slams simultaneously. Which for you would be more impressive, Carl? A 12th French Open title for Rafa Nadal, or Novak getting four in a row once more?
I think Novak getting four in a row. I think it's so, so tough to do. You know, if you look at the modern day tennis players today, and a lot, and you know, us as pundits or whatever you want to call us, we are so quick to write off people. And I remember when I was doing a sports night with you at one stage, I think you were struggling for numbers and you gave me a last minute phone call. I was available and we were chatting about it, and at that stage Novak was in the hole, and you know, we were saying, is his career over? Will he ever come back? He was struggling with injury, had a few personal problems, and for him to come out of that again and basically dominate the way he has, Robbie, I think that's an unbelievable record. I think it's a list of 8 players in the world that have won all 4, if memory serves me correct. And I mean, to be able to hold them at the same time, I think will be an unbelievable record. But I tell you what, Rafa Nadal once again proved last week it is no easy fight. He is the king of clay. He loves that court. He owns it. And I think it will take a lot to get past him this season.
Will it be Rafa, a 12th title for him? Will it be Novak winning yet another 4 consecutive Grand Slam titles? Or maybe, just maybe, someone like Dominic Thiem can put a new name on that trophy. It's going to be a tall order for the likes of Thiem, for the likes of Alex Zverev as well, who's been struggling for form a little bit, has the German this season on the tennis circuit. Loads of intrigue ahead of the French Open. You've got to fancy Simona Halep going into the ladies' draw as the defending champion, as the lady who's got the best chance of winning the French Open title. Lots more to come on the show between now and 6 o'clock. We're going to focus on cricket next hour. It is the ICC Cricket World Cup. We're just days away now. It all gets underway on Thursday.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.